loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Tensions mount in Brazil as the country's largest party breaks away from President Dilma Rousseff's coalition, paving the way for her possible impeachment. Polarization is growing with protests continuing on both sides of the political and class divide. Where is Brazil heading, and who are the forces who want Dilma out of office? The U.S. Department of Justice has dropped its case against Apple after it said it had successfully unlocked the phone belonging to one of the San Bernardino shooters. This came as researchers from Johns Hopkins University found a bug in Apple's encryption. We'll take a look at just how secure your iPhone actually is. Palestinians commemorate Land Day today, which marks the 1976 killing of six unarmed Arab civilians by Israeli authorities following a major Israeli land grab in Palestinian territories. 40 years on, could there be a new intifada brewing in the West Bank, Gaza, and inside of Israel? But first we turn to Brazil. We are joined by Kim Ives. He is the contributing editor to Haiti Liberté, a prolific writer on the Caribbean and Latin America. Welcome, Kim Ives.
Thank you, Brian.
Brazil's largest party, the Democratic Movement Party, leaves the coalition today. How major is this announcement, and what are the possible outcomes of it? Does it spell the possible end of the government of Dilma's Workers' Party?
Well, clearly it's a huge blow to the Workers' Party. The Workers' Party itself, it should be said, is itself a coalition. And so it's really a coalition within a coalition. And having spent several days in the Brazilian parliament, it's really just a tremendous marketplace, just a teeming sort of beehive with Amazonian tribes performing dances in the hallways and people sort of running. But it's a very tumultuous and dynamic place. So I don't think it's impossible that they could possibly pull a number of PM people back from the brink and prevent the impeachment. But it's looking less and less like that, because I think the whole campaign and energy and momentum is really on the side of those who are carrying out this coup. I think it's clearly some sort of coup, which is going to try to push Brazil back to the right after 13 years of inching left.
Kim Ives, for our listeners in the United States who are getting their understanding of what's going on in Brazil, mainly from the corporate-owned media, the story is presented like this. There is the issue of corruption. It's the corruption of Lula, the corruption of Rousseff, the corruption of the Workers' Party-led government, that there is no political or class conflict going on, that it really is about good government or clean government. Help our audience understand the larger political and social context for the current political crisis in Brazil.
Well, I think the larger macro context is the U.S. is basically waging a war. We could call it even the Third World War against the BRICS. That's the BRICS are Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. The war against China and Russia is pretty apparent. The bellicose maneuvers and encirclement with U.S. bases of Russia and China. That's pretty clear. But I think on the political level, they're working as well against Brazil in particular, which has been a Colossus in South American continent, and it's a very tricky relationship. In the case of Haiti, for example, we've seen Brazil has worked with the U.S. to carry out the military occupation under the aegis of the UN of Haiti since 2004. This is an occupation which was supposed to take only 6 months, and now here we are in its 12th year. And the irony of it...
And that was following the coup in Haiti.
And that was following the coup d'etat against President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And the similarities, ironically, the similarities between this campaign against Dilma Rousseff and that against Jean-Bertrand Aristide are very great. Essentially, they have mounted a media, political, economic, a diplomatic, multi-front campaign to essentially drive this government from power. And I think it's very clear that Dilma Rousseff is practically one of the few politicians in Brazil who is not affected by this corruption scandal. But, another element of it, really, Brian, is that, they're focusing on Petrobras and the corruption. This was a trough of corruption, and they were using – well, the real target is Petrobras itself, because this is a state-owned oil company, and this is anathema to the business press, which is the principal place. If you Google Brazil, you'll see it's Fortune, The Economist, Forbes, etc., that the articles come up. But they don't want to see Petrobras. They want it broken up. They can't stand this idea of a country, of a nation, of the people of a nation controlling their own wealth, especially an oil company. So very much the campaign against Rousseff is the same campaign we see against Maduro in Venezuela, and is the same campaign we saw against Aristide in Haiti 12 years ago.
And when you look at the big picture of Latin America, and you put what's going on in Brazil, which of course, as the biggest country in Latin America and the biggest economy, and as you mentioned, part of the BRICS, which is a sort of a new non-American dominated constellation of world powers that includes Russia and China and India and South Africa and Brazil. When you look at what's going on in Latin America, you not only have the parliamentary setback for the Maduro government, the PSUV, the Socialist Party that was leading the Bolivarian Revolution, but there has been a big change in Argentina. The Kirchner government has been replaced by a neoliberal right-wing government. The coup, in Honduras in 2011. I mean, the trajectory was going left in Latin America. Brazil was part of it and sort of a moderate left. Maduro in Venezuela with Cuba, a more radical left. But is the pendulum shifting back? And why has the left in Latin America encountered these kind of problems? What's the basic reason that they have not been able to consolidate their gains and take the next steps, for instance?
Well, I think the U.S. has been picking off these pink countries, if we can call them, one by one. Chile, Paraguay, Uruguay, now Brazil, Argentina, as you mentioned. So they're gradually reeling them back into the U.S. sphere, trying to stamp out this these political revolutions, which began, I should mention again, in Haiti in 1990 with the election of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And everybody said, wow, it's possible to carry out a political revolution in these U.S.-engineered elections that the U.S. was carrying out everywhere with the support of the National Endowment for Democracy and its two arms, the International Republican Institute, IRI, and the National Democratic Institute, NDI. And they would go into these countries and essentially orchestrate these elections, and they foiled it in Haiti with Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 1990. And then Hugo Chavez in Venezuela said, hey, we can do that too. And they did it in 1999 in Venezuela. And they continued to do it through countries throughout the continent. And this is now what is being gradually pushed back. And just to go to the larger picture again, you know, this dynamic is, we've been seeing it for decades. This is the nature of the world we live in, of imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism. Lenin was writing about it a century ago, where he said, when you have these dominant powers that they are fighting with the emerging powers, such as coming up through history, we can look at England, which was the dominant power a century ago, had to fight against the others emerging, like America, like the United States of America at the time. So this is really just a replay today between the dominant USA versus the BRICS that are coming up.
Well, if the Russoff government falls, if it's toppled, what would that mean for BRICS? Because, of course, Lula and that particular political trajectory or political orientation in Brazil has been very central to the rise of the of BRICS. And what about the people in Brazil? Right now you have massive protests on both sides. Who's supporting the current government and who's leading these massive protests? The big protests in support of the government are not really getting much attention in the U.S. media.
Correct. And this was the same thing again. I keep going back to Haiti. Again, the irony being that Brazil has been the U.S. proxy in Haiti, basically overseeing the military occupation of the country for the past 12 years. They're about to be removed from that role and replaced by Canada. But essentially, that was the same thing. When they were pushing out Aristide, back in 2004, you'd had these little demonstrations. I mean, they weren't little. They had several thousand people, but you'd have these massive demonstrations, gigantic, a million people at one point, which would be about a tenth of Haiti's population came out. But that was completely blacked out in the press or whited out, and you never heard about it. But it, to me, it's a very similar situation in Brazil. The spotlight is really on the people in the streets, and it's for sure people are scared with Zika. There's a huge water problem in Sao Paulo. People can't get water to drink. You have, the Brazilian national team getting beaten 7-0 or whatever it was a couple of years ago. You have just a number of psychological, economic, political factors which have created a perfect storm in Brazil. So to me, the fundamentals are, though, that this was an attempt, at least, at a workers' government. You really did have some form of heightened democracy under the Workers' Party, and this is really what the empire, through its proxies, through its agents, through its very sophisticated laboratory, as the Haitians call it, are pushing back. And I think it's going to have a huge effect on the BRIC movement generally, because Brazil is a key to it. Sure, Russia and China are the biggest heavyweights, but Brazil, at least in the Western Hemisphere, plays a key role as a semi-pole against the U.S. power in the North.
When Lula left office, still very, very popular, but now under indictment, Dilma appointed him to give him a position as a chief of staff or something like that, which under certain or normal circumstances would give him immunity. What about Lula and Lula's leadership now?
Well, Lula, I think, again, this was part of the psychological war. They needed that picture of Lula being led out in handcuffs, subdued, humiliated, just that picture, that idea, that image of this iconic figure in Brazilian history who came up from the streets and became the president and a successful president and created a movement. This was key to the psychological war that the U.S. And its minions are waging. And I think we can't underestimate the power that he may be able to muster from the streets, from the people who, to me, still do hold him, revere him as one of Brazilian history's greatest leaders. So I don't know if they're going to be able to really snatch victory from the jaws of defeat, but it's for sure they're in meetings right now trying to figure out how to push back against this defection of the PMDB and to see how to hold off the push to remove Dilma. She, again, is one of the most unimpeachably honest figures. I mean, a former guerrilla. She's an economist. She's very capable. She's a unifier. But this is something where the media and the psychological game that they're playing somehow trumps reality.
In the case of Venezuela, and as the polarization there deepened and continues to deepen, even though the PSUV, Maduro, the successor to Chavez, suffered a very, very major parliamentary defeat in the last election, you still have a society whereby large parts of the poor, which, of course, is the majority part of the population, benefited from the Bolivarian process. They benefited from the reforms. There were social programs designed to alleviate poverty and to bring health care. There was a palpable increase for the poor especially. And so even though there's been divisions within the Venezuelan process, there still is the reality that these programs exist and that they're helping people. Was there a similar process with the Brazilian Workers' Party?
Oh, absolutely. The Workers' Party did do a lot to raise the standards of living of the poor. You have an alliance with the MST, the Movement Sem Terras, the Landless Peasants Movement, which is based primarily in the Northeast. And you really see throughout, for example, around Sao Paulo, you go and you see the popular schools that they built in these popular suburbs of Brazil's large cities, Brasilia, Sao Paulo, etc. So really, and we have to say Sao Paulo is the largest metropole of Latin America. So this is a party, yes, which has raised people up. But as we can see, the power of the ruling of the bourgeoisie there has not been taken away. And, you know, a political revolution, which doesn't change the ownership, particularly of things like the means of the media, is going to be facing some serious challenges, as we're seeing today.
We're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking to Kim Ives. He's a contributing editor to Haiti Liberté. He's a journalist and author. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The U.S. Department of Justice has dropped its case against Apple after it said it had successfully unlocked the phone belonging to one of the San Bernardino shooters. But researchers from Johns Hopkins University found a bug in Apple's encryption. We'll take a look at just how secure your iPhone actually is and where this confrontation, or if it's a confrontation, is likely to go. We're joined by Declan McCullough from California. He is a technology journalist and the founder of the company Recent. Welcome back, Declan.
Hi there. Thanks for having me back here again.
Okay. The Justice Department announced Monday that its legal case against Apple has been dropped, at least for now. What happened?
Well, what happened is we don't know what happened, to be blunt. The FBI said they no longer need Apple's help and basically backed off on this court case. But this is not the end of the broader war for a number of reasons. The first is that there are other cases pending. Even if the FBI never brings any cases again against Apple, there are other state, local, and other federal agencies that might. So we haven't seen the last of this issue by any means.
I mean, San Bernardino seemed to be sort of a perfect sort of foundation for the Justice Department and the FBI's case because it was such an emotional moment. I mean, here you have workers being gunned down by a coworker who's secretly associated with or sympathetic to ISIS or ISIL, Daesh, the so-called Islamic State. I mean, there's a lot of emotion, a lot of rage and fear there. So they demanded that Apple give them the phone, and Apple, and they said if Apple didn't do it, they were in essence aiding and abetting terrorists. I mean, that was the bottom line of what the message was. But then it turns out, well, hey, actually, we don't need it. Did they ever really need Apple's cooperation, or was this about the government leaning on private corporations to make them sort of bend, genuflect in front of the government's national surveillance state?
Well, my guess is that the FBI did not need Apple's cooperation even from the beginning. Now, I'm not accusing the FBI of lying. My suspicion is instead they just didn't do their due diligence. Instead of asking every single company that could help, they just took the easy way out and went straight to Apple. And Israeli press reporting that Cellebrite, a company based in Israel, is working with the FBI. They seem to be well-respected and have the technical ability to help the FBI remove the memory chip, copying it, testing passphrases until it wipes itself, they copy the contents back, try again until you succeed. And so instead of contacting everyone in the computer forensics community, they could. Apple was the target. And the FBI viewed this, I suspect, as a test case. They chose the case with a lot of emotion, also where the facts were on their side. It's pretty clear that the folks who owned the phone gave permission. It's the county that employed the terrorists, the murderers in San Bernardino. They gave permission for the phone to be searched, and also there's no privacy interest. The people who use the phone are dead. They were shot in the attack. So this is, from the FBI's perspective, this would have been a very good case, and I think they were taken aback by the fact that Apple fought this so strongly.
And it wasn't just Apple. I mean, Apple stood up, but they got an immense amount of support from, I think, Microsoft and Google, other companies, and even though the media was kind of quoting people who thought they should cooperate with the FBI, the fact of the matter is people who care about civil liberties and civil rights, who care about the overreach of Big Brother America, they were standing with Apple. In other words, did the government sort of drop the case because of the backlash of public opinion, or was it because they suddenly found another way to open that particular phone? What's your guess?
I don't think that the government backed off just because of public opinion. I mean, sometimes this is what you have to do as a prosecutor. You have to stick with a case even though the polls were against you. I think they backed off because they were getting contacted by forensics companies saying, hey, well, give our technology a shot. And they also backed off because they did not want to set a precedent. They did not want this case to go up to the Ninth Circuit and then the Supreme Court, and then they lose. That's why I think they backed off. Even though, as you said, a lot of companies and my company would be my company would be unable to comply with this kind of court order, at least easily. We have no process to use. This is why Google and Facebook and Twitter and Microsoft and everyone else filed an amicus brief in the case. It would have disrupted Silicon Valley tremendously to build in back doors into our products. And I think there was a bit of a political calculus as well in backing off, but not because of polls. It was because of the lack of or the unanimity in Silicon Valley.
Yeah. Now, what's actually happened? According to the media report, researchers at Johns Hopkins University found that Apple's encryption could be compromised, and Apple has now vowed to fix it. But how big of a revelation is that? And of course, since the Snowden revelations, and of course, because Apple wants to sell its products internationally, where there's huge amounts of skepticism about American companies cooperating with the NSA to carry out surveillance. I mean, does this mean that Apple's encryption system really isn't as strong as Apple is making it out to be?
I wouldn't read too much into the Johns Hopkins work, which is brilliant, but at least my understanding of it is that the FBI is likely relying on a hardware attack, and that means actually slicing open the phone very, very carefully, removing the chip, and then attacking it that way. And so this is let me back up and say any complicated operating system, whether it's made by Google in the form of Android or Apple in the form of iOS, is always under attack. Humans are imperfect creatures. Whenever we build code, we inject some errors inadvertently. I've made my own share of bugs when I was designing code for our own news app. And so it's a constant race of the attackers versus the defense, and you release bug fixes and you try to keep ahead of the attackers when you're designing an operating system.
So what will happen now? I mean, what's exactly going to happen? Will the court case will be over because the government has dropped it without a plaintiff? There's no need for the court case to go forward. But do you believe that if this was a case, but there are other cases, do you think that we're going to see sometime very, very soon the same sort of case where the Justice Department and the FBI say, as a matter of national security, to keep the country safe, to keep us safe from terrorism, that the companies that want to encrypt and want to provide security and want to maintain the integrity of their products, they're just going to have to give up and give that power over to the NSA or to the FBI? In other words, sabotage their own products. Do you think that's coming?
It is. The FBI and the Department of Justice take the long view. They have been demanding, requesting, asking for whatever phrasing you want to use, but they've wanted backdoors and encryption systems for over 20 years. This was the law called CALEA was enacted by Congress in 1994 and signed into law by President Clinton. And this says that the telephone companies, not computer companies, not software companies, but only telephone companies have to build backdoors in. There were attempts to extend that to software companies and operating system makers, and those failed. So the FBI takes the long view. We will see this again. There was a case in the Eastern District of New York, this is the Brooklyn case, where the FBI was trying for a very similar order under the All Writs Act against Apple, and the judge in that case said the FBI has been trying this in, the quote is, a dozen more such applications pending. So if the FBI is trying in a dozen other cases that we know about, this is I don't think this is over. We might just have a respite for a while.
What is the All Writs Act?
The All Writs Act is a general purpose law that's over 200 years old that says that a judge in a civil or criminal proceeding can order a party to the proceeding to help in the administration of justice. It's very vague, but it's things like, yeah, like if a telephone company can be required to turn over records, that's something that is pretty straightforward and doesn't require the telephone company to create an entirely new version of the operating system. It's never been used in the past. This is unprecedented to create a software company like Apple. Or to force them to create an entirely new version of the operating system that might take one man year, one person year of work that undermines its own security. And so this is a point that a lot of us out here in Silicon Valley have been making. Look, Department of Justice, if you really need this authority, let's have a debate before Congress and ask for the authority. Let's have an open debate as opposed to doing this in largely secret court proceedings that are taking place under seal. The FBI has wanted this law, but Congress has rejected the request twice in the 90s and also a few years ago. This is the so-called going dark issue. In my view, the FBI is trying this end run around Congress by asking the courts to give it this new power that Congress has not.
Wouldn't it be better for technology companies like Apple or for people who care about civil liberties and civil rights to be proactive then and say and make a major campaign rather than be simply reactive to the next government demand following the next terrorist action, because there probably will be one? But wouldn't it be right for the technology companies and people like you and all the people who care to have a proactive campaign saying right now, right here, this is number one issue, the issue of privacy, which goes to the heart of the Bill of Rights, the heart of the American Constitution. Let's have that debate now and make it out in the open rather than being in a context where you're reacting to a terrorist action where all the emotions are so high and the media has become so hysterical. Why don't the companies, or why doesn't Silicon Valley just start that process?
Your suggestion makes a lot of sense, I think Silicon Valley is edging in that direction. But keep in mind that folks out here just want to build amazing products. They aren't as focused on government lobbying and dealing as the East Coast companies are. So it's going to take a lot for this to happen. But maybe the FBI's requests in this case are enough. This unified response on Silicon Valley's part actually did take place a few years ago when the motion picture industry and other large copyright holders were trying to get a law called SOPA through that would shut down large portions of the Internet. And Google and other Yahoo, Wikipedia turned their pages dark. They warned users about this. They deluged Congress with phone calls. And this could happen again. But keep in mind that, you know, companies are happy to respond to legitimate requests that are backed up by law and court orders for information. Crime exists, terrorism exists, I don't think they want to put themselves in a position of fighting against law enforcement. It's just that when law enforcement demands are unreasonable, that's when you get this pushback.
We're talking to Declan McCullough about the Apple FBI controversy. The FBI and the Justice Department have dropped the case right now, but it's going to come back. We can see the handwriting on the wall. I mean, it's not an if, it's a when. And, you know, you mentioned, Declan, that the companies want to build their products. They're focused on building products and selling products, but they are already major lobbyists. They don't have a small operation. They have a major operation of lobbying going on in Washington, D.C. And since the writing is on the wall, we can see what's coming. I want to just go back and just push you a little bit more on it. Why not make this a priority? Because ultimately, it is about everyone's privacy. You know, Edward Snowden, when he was talking, I think, with Glenn Greenwald and Chomsky the other day, he said, he made the point, the Brussels attack could have been stopped. You know, not because of the absence of surveillance technology, but the failure of certain law enforcement and intelligence. The same with the Paris attack. In other words, these attacks are going to come. They're always going to make the case. You have to give up your civil rights and civil liberties. We see it coming. Why not make this the push right now?
Let me answer your first point first, or at least try to address it. And that is, how much influence do these companies have in Washington? Silicon Valley is fortunately, and let's keep it this way, not a regulated industry. It's not like you have the Federal Bureau of Software Regulation saying that Apple has to wait another week to release a new version of iOS, or that a certain Android app can charge 99 cents versus $1.99. The companies that have the biggest presence in Washington are the ones that are regulated by the FCC or the Department of Energy or the Department of Transportation. And those are the ones who have hundreds of lobbyists. The software companies don't. We've been fighting a largely defensive battle over the last few decades, so we can keep releasing software products that people find useful. And so I don't think we'd have the influence that you might think, given, even though these are some of the largest companies in the world. It's basically more hands-off compared to ones who are regulated. As to the other point, you're right. I mean, freedom, privacy, other freedoms, including free speech, it's an ongoing fight. Government the impulse of government is to get bigger and to increase surveillance or increase censorship. So there's no easy way out. It's the fight just keeps on going.
We've been talking to Declan McCullough. He is the technology journalist and the founder of the company Recent. We've been talking about the Justice Department has dropped its case against Apple. It's a fascinating discussion because, as Declan has said, and as we've talked about, this case may be over, but many, many more cases are on the way. It's a fundamental struggle over privacy and people's rights and whether they can have encrypted technology that prevents the government from listening to them without probable cause. We're going to have to pick it up, though, the next time. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. This is Loud and Clear. Palestinians commemorate Land Day today, which marks the 1976 killing of six unarmed Arab civilians by Israeli authorities after major protests were held against Israel's seizure of Palestinian land. 40 years on, could there be a new intifada brewing in the West Bank, Gaza, and Israel proper? We are joined from New York by author Dr. Norman Finkelstein. He is a U.S. political scientist, an activist, and an author. His primary fields of research are the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the politics of the Holocaust, an interest motivated by the experiences of his parents, who were Jewish Holocaust survivors. Welcome, Dr. Finkelstein.
Thank you for having me.
Last Thursday morning, Israeli soldiers shot dead two Palestinians in the West Bank city of Hebron. Video caught on an IDF soldier, that's the Israeli Defense Forces soldier, shooting one of the men in the head at point-blank range after he was wounded. Talk about that incident and what the mood is both among Palestinians right now and also within the Israeli public.
A number of commentators have already said that the only distinguishing feature of that particular incident was that it was caught on video, that these sorts of killings and subsequent indifference are not fairly typical, but wholly typical of what goes on in the occupied Palestinian territories. And it has to be said, without in any way diminishing the savagery of what was on display in the video, that it's kind of old news if you read the human rights reports on what goes on each time Israel launches another of its brutal operations against Gaza. In each and every one of these operations, the scenario is the same. You have people carrying white sheets or white flags to indicate they're civilians. They're shot dead. Ambulances are denied entry to try to rescue those who are injured. Ambulances are then typically fired on by missiles. Ambulance drivers and other medical crew are killed. Sometimes a second ambulance comes. It too is fired on by a missile. The people who were originally injured and triggered the ambulances, they're left to bleed to death. This is not hyperbole. It's not exaggeration. It's been documented over and over and over again in human rights reports. The only distinguishing features of what happened in Hebron were, number one, it was technically not in a war situation, and number two, it was caught on video.
Well, the video has elicited this very, well, what might seem strange anywhere else, public opinion within Israel, where an online petition has been established calling on Israel to give the soldier a medal. The wounded man was already immobilized. The soldier walks up and shoots him in the head. It's on video. And you say that's not unusual. What's unusual, it's caught on video. But then having had it caught on video and having it be condemned by people all over the world who were horrified when they saw it, this online petition now has almost 50,000 signatures within Israel asking for the government to give that soldier a medal.
Well, after each of Israel's savage operations in Gaza, there are typically calls to give the most murderous of the soldiers medals also. If you know the history and you follow the detail, that's not altogether surprising either. Just to take the one memory that looms large, when Baruch Goldstein committed the Hebron massacre in 1994, he went in and killed several tens of Palestinians in a mosque as they were praying. Kiryat Arba, one of the settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, built a shrine for him, and it became a place of pilgrimage for Palestinians until, I think at some point, I can't remember when, the Israeli government was a little bit embarrassed. My memory is they were forced to, after a significant period of time had elapsed, the shrine was, I think, dismantled, but my memory is not clear. But that sort of stuff is just kind of a commonplace in the occupied territories and among Israelis. Look, Israel is it's a brutalized population. It carries on like the Wild West. It's dug in its heels like white South Africans during the 1980s. It carries on like the lunatics in the American South during the desegregation struggle. When blacks and whites were killed, the standard response of the Southern whites was they asked for it. So this kind of brutalized behavior by these supremacists, these Jewish supremacists, these racists, I think it's fair to say that Israel has become a deranged society. If there's any doubt on that score, their current prime minister is a certifiable psychopath, but he keeps getting reelected in Israel. I think it's now some 12 years. He's the longest sitting prime minister, I think, except for David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister. He's an obnoxious, loudmouth, Jewish supremacist, racist Jew, and that he is the real face of Israel, which is why he keeps getting reelected. So why would anyone be surprised that if the head of state is a certifiable maniac, a pathologue, that the population would react as it does to these scenes? What's most surprising is they react at all, because if you watched, I guess it was in a sequence, it was the second of the videos, they didn't even notice the body on the floor. It reminded me there was a lunatic settler in the 1990s. I don't know if he's still around, Rabbi Levinger. And he was once asked about Arabs. And he said, and I'm quoting him, "Sure, I care about Arabs. I also care about flies." And that's the mentality. They swatted the fly, so why should anyone pause for a moment?
Yeah, they certainly didn't pause in that video. He's just shot. The blood is rushing out of his head, and the soldiers talk with each other, and they sort of just try to maneuver an ambulance so its bumper doesn't bump into something. Netanyahu said after the killing and after this video elicited, again, internationally great outrage, he said, "Any challenge to the morality of the Israeli Defense Forces is outrageous and unacceptable. The soldiers of the IDF, our children, maintain high ethical values while courageously fighting against bloodthirsty murderers under difficult operational conditions." I mean, there's nothing about that statement that conforms to the video. There was they weren't in any sort of danger. The guy was lying on the ground. He was immobilized. And they just shot him and then went about their business. According to the Palestine News and Information Center, 61 Palestinians have been killed in that area in Hebron since October 2015. I mean, do you feel, Norman Finkelstein, that the situation, the murders, the repression, the racism, the viciousness of the occupation is leading to a third intifada?
No, there's no evidence for that. No, that doesn't mean it won't happen. But there's currently no evidence of that. And the reasons are pretty straightforward. The two critical factors for any uprising to occur don't exist there. Number one, there's no organization. The organizations that existed in the occupied territories beginning in the 1970s and climaxing in the first intifada in 1987 to 1993, those organizations, the mass organizations, women's organizations, unions, so forth, they've all been hollowed out by the Palestinian Authority. They're just skeletons to pretend that there are organizations there, but there's no mass organization or incipient mass organization there. People have, at this point in time, they've given up. They've given up on politics. They've become cynical of politics. They've become atomized. It's basically a society of every man for himself. Anybody who has any talent and ability has been bought off by the NGOs, the non-government organizations, which dot Ramallah, and in exchange for a salary which, relatively speaking, is significantly higher than that of a typical Palestinian, they get to live a good life in Ramallah, relatively speaking. Ramallah is actually among the most expensive places in the world nowadays to live. They live a relatively good life doing nothing or pretending they're doing something, like writing periodic reports on Palestine's economy, even though Palestine has no economy. It survives totally on foreign largesse. And so all the talented people who normally would have peopled the mass organizations, say the same kind of person who would have peopled those organizations in the 70s and 80s, they now live a relatively good life in Ramallah. The quid pro quo is that they don't do anything. If they start doing anything significant, they will lose those perquisites of belonging to the NGO system. And on the other side, there's no leadership. The Palestinian Authority is bought and paid for by Israel and the United States. They follow the orders of Israel and the United States, and they're simply now a conveyor belt in the torture of the Palestinians. There was a good report put out a few weeks ago by two Israeli human rights organizations. I think it's called Backed by the System. And the essence was Palestinian preventive security. It tortures Palestinians using serious torture, as the report calls it, seriously tortures the Palestinians. And then after they finish torturing the Palestinians, they let them go. And with the promise that within a week's time, they'll be picked up by Israeli torturers. Then the Israeli torturers get to work on them. And the file on these torture detainees, it's just passed on from the Palestinian preventive security to the Israeli security agencies. It's a conveyor belt of torture, and that's the basic purpose now of the Palestinian Authority, to repress the Palestinians and to collect their paychecks. So in the absence of leadership and the absence of organization, I think it's unrealistic to expect that there will be any enduring or significant response to what's going on.
Norman Finkelstein, we're talking on this, the 40th anniversary of Land Day, and you're presenting a pretty bleak picture for the Palestinians. Of course, they have the Israelis on the one side, the terrible repression and occupation and murder like the one we saw and the ones we've seen over and over again. At the same time, you say there's the absence of leadership and the absence of organization, two essential ingredients for a third intifada. I'd like to talk to you about what's going on inside the United States and particularly inside the American Jewish community, because it seems that while Netanyahu and the Israeli society has gone further and further and further in the same direction, there's been a greater rejection of that direction by significant and growing numbers of American Jews. There was just protests at the APEC conference again this year. There were large demonstrations, and they were Arab Americans and Jewish Americans and people who are from all walks of life. But just talk about how you view the evolution or the trajectory of public opinion within the Jewish community here in the United States.
Since the early 1980s, since the 1982 Lebanon War, followed by the 1987 First Intifada, followed by the brutal repression of the Second Intifada, and then followed by the successive murderous, savage attacks on Gaza, there's been a progressive diminution in support among American Jews for Israel, and particularly among the younger generation. It doesn't mean that they don't support Israel's existence, though they still do. And it doesn't mean they're going to come out swinging against Israel. They won't. But there has certainly been a significant erosion of support for Israel and a recognition that Israel has become more an embarrassment than a source of pride, and better not spoken of because its actions are indefensible.
That's all the time we have. We want to thank Norman Finkelstein for joining us. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.